Welcome back. You have found Wooden Sticks here on the Talk North Pod Network. My name is Kevin Gork, the host of the program. Really excited about where we're headed today. We're going to have Danny Brooks on, the son of legendary coach Herb Brooks, who we lost some 21 years ago back in 2003. Hard to believe. I grew up playing hockey on the opposite side of town, but against Danny Brooks. He was a youth hockey player over in Moundsview. Terrific player, too. Big, strong kid. I think at one point had a hat trick in one of those tournament games on me at Columbia Arena. I remember it vividly. He was a star player there. Would go on and had to travel a lot as he grew up with his dad moving all over the world with his great coaching career, but ended up playing his high school hockey at St. Thomas Academy, played college hockey for the Denver Pioneers. And I thought it was a perfect time to reconnect with my friend Dan Brooks, because next week when the Frozen Four comes back to St. Paul, it's the 50-year anniversary of his dad's first national championship with Minnesota. It was 1974. And being that Herb was a St. Paul guy and St. Paul is hosting this great college hockey event, it's going to be awesome. And to see that Dan Brooks is going to drop the puck at center ice, knowing that the Denver Pioneers, where he played, are a part of this Frozen Four. And you've got some amazing programs with Michigan, Boston College, Boston University, some of the legendary college hockey teams. It's going to be an unbelievable weekend in St. Paul. And so for Danny to be a part of that, it really gave me the idea to have him on the show. And you know, we're going to be fortunate enough today to get to hear firsthand what it was like to be a part of that unbelievable coaching career that Herb had. And he built the Minnesota hockey program into a power in the 70s. He won three national championships there and would go on to be the head coach behind, if it's not the greatest sporting endeavor, it's got to be one of, for me, it's the best, 1980, Team USA, the Miracle on Ice, the gold medal. We know the movie Miracle, but now we get to actually live it in the eyes of his son at the time, who was a teenager, 12 or 13 years old. Just a remarkable story that Dan has. And, you know, his hockey story goes much deeper than his dad. As I mentioned, he was an awesome player. And what I've always loved about Danny Brooks is, you know, he was always a big deal. And going back to when we played youth hockey, we all knew his dad was the coach of the Gophers. Later in life, when he played high school hockey, we all knew his dad was the Miracle on Ice man and coached in the National Hockey League at places like New York, New Jersey, Pittsburgh, and yes, our beloved North Stars back in the day. But he never acted like that. He was always so down to earth. And, you know, he was so approachable and such a great guy to get to know. And that's the cool thing about playing hockey in Minnesota is you get to know everybody else on the opposite team. And, you know, there are jerks out there, right? And in all walks of life, whether it's hockey, whether it's life, whatever. But, you know, he was always such a good human being. And that's carried over into all aspects of his life. And he's been tremendously successful in the financial world. And I'm not surprised. You know, I've known Danny for a long, long time. And he's always been remarkably smart, gifted in everything he does. But bottom line is, he's always been a great person. And I think when you're a great person, people want to work with you, whether it's at the rink or in the financial world. It doesn't surprise me that he's killing it. And he lives, I think, part of the year here in Minnesota, part of the year out in California. We'll dive into that story as well. Bottom line is, I'm just really excited to connect with a friend, a guy that I really look up to, really respect. And I was lucky enough, you know, as a kid to get to know his dad. And we'll talk about it on the podcast when we have Danny on. But my dad was the head golf professional down at the Faribault Golf and Country Club for over 40 years. And Herb Brooks did his big hockey school in Faribault at the Shattuck campus, at Shattuck St. Mary's. And so early on in Herbie's time in Faribault, he connected with my dad and they worked out a deal where Herbie basically said, "Hey, I want to bring my coaches out here. We're going to be down in the Faribault area." I think at the time they were maybe 4 or 5 weeks. They'd run the camp down there in the heart of summer. And he wanted to bring the coaches out and play golf and get a cart and go out and have a good time and, you know, have a few beers and let off some steam. And he knew that my dad had a kid that played hockey. And so basically I got to go over to the hockey school for as many weeks as I wanted with free room and board and got to go to the camp. And the camp was unbelievable. You know, at the time, you know, because it was Herb Brooks and he was the head coach at Minnesota, This is prior to the Miracle on Ice. I mean, everybody wanted to be a part of this hockey camp. Minnesota Hockey School was a big deal. And I remember it vividly because, you know, Herbie at night, you know, we'd have two different sessions on the ice. We'd have one session of actual off-ice training, and then we'd have free time and, you know, like we'd play games and do other things off the ice. But then after dinner every night, you'd go into the lecture theater and Herbie and some of the coaches would put on these videos, and they were reels of highlights of great Gopher teams for all these, you know, 1970s, you know, huge successful WCHA teams, national championship teams. And you'd watch these 2 hour like highlights of the entire season. And it was really fun and really cool. And later in life, when I got to the state tournament in 1985, I've told this story before. I think I've told it here on Wooden Sticks, but the game that I played in my very first state tournament as a senior goalie for Burnsville was the final game on the slate on that Thursday in 1985. Well, the game before us was a game between Bloomington Jefferson and Minnetonka that would go into five overtimes. Now, eventually they had to stop the game and play it and finish it the very next morning. But the bottom line is our game was delayed by like 3 hours. And back then it was such a big deal. The state tournament being on TV, the one tournament format, the fact that we didn't have cable and the tournament was on at the time WCCO. So it was one of like four or five channels that anybody could watch in this market. They put a ton of money into this broadcast. Well, they had multiple sets, but the in-between period set was down by the locker rooms, kind of underneath the bleachers behind one of the nets at the Civic Center. And Herb worked in between periods from that desk, and he could see me outside the locker room in my gear, kind of pacing around waiting for the goal to score, because as soon as the puck goes in, warm-ups are going to start. So we had to kind of keep most of our gear on and wait for the overtime to finish. And he could see I was a nervous wreck, which I was. Called me over to the set. He said, "Hey, you know, you're Kenny Gorick's kid." I said, "Yes, I am." Introduced myself. And this is a few years removed from Miracle on Ice. So this is a pretty big deal for a high school kid to get the chance to talk to Herb Brooks. And literally, when he wasn't on the set working during those intermissions for a couple hours, we just sat and talked. And he was making me laugh, helping me, you know, just not have to worry about when my game was going to start. And I'll never forget that for as long as I live. Just how generous he was with his time. What a big deal that was for me as a high school kid to get that time with Herbie Brooks. It's still one of the most magical weekends of my life. And a big part of it, yes, we ended up winning the tournament, but really having that time with Herb Brooks was second to none. The other story I want to tell, much later in life, I was coaching women's college hockey at St. Thomas. So this is the early 2000s. Herb passed away in 2003. So this was probably 2001, 2002. And I had done some state tournaments both on the radio and on Fox 9. I worked with Jim Rich, had a chance to work some of the day games. It was a big thrill to be on TV and to broadcast while I was still coaching college hockey. And my assistant coach was Tom Pelkowski, and he worked in mortgage. Herbie was doing something with Pelko in the mortgage business and had gone into the office and was kind of rummaging around as Herb wanted to do and looking at pictures and saw a team picture up of our St. Thomas team and started asking questions of Tom about where he was coaching, who he was coaching with. And my name came up. He said, "Yeah, I work with Kevin Gorick over at St. Thomas. And are you going to see Kevin anytime soon?" And Pelko said, "Yeah, I'll probably see him at practice later today." And he said, "Well, get him a message for me." And so I'll never forget it. I was at the rink getting ready to run practice. And our team was really kind of coming at that time. We were getting pretty good and we were having a great time. The message from Herb Brooks through my assistant coach, Tom Pelkowski, was this: "Hey, you're probably a really good coach. Looks like you're having a lot of success at St. Thomas. But I got to tell you, I've watched you. I've listened to you on the broadcast side of things. And you've got a real gift. If you get the chance, you should seriously consider moving into full-time broadcasting." And I thought that was unbelievably cool, right? I mean, as far as people in this market that know the game and love the game, Herb Brooks was at the top of the list at that point in my life. And when I got that message, I mean, I had wings. And it took a couple of years until the opportunity kind of came full circle. But I had to make a really hard choice after the 2007 season at St. Thomas, because I really enjoyed coaching, especially St. Thomas and recruiting on the women's side. We were having a lot of success and a lot of fun. But I went back to that message from, and it was a quick message, right? It took my assistant coach, Tom, maybe 45 seconds to relay the message. had a huge impact on my life, because in 2007, I actually made that decision to go full time. And at the time it was Fox Sports North, and I haven't looked back, and I've been extremely blessed from that decision. And again, Herbie had a big part of it. And so to connect with Danny again, who I've known for years, and to tell some stories from his perspective on his family, on his dad, on some of those big moments in time, I truthfully could not be more excited today on Wooden Sticks to have Dan Brooks as our special guest. Before we get to Danny, we're going to have a quick break here. And I want to remind you, we've got some open space here, open real estate on our show. We'd love to pump up whatever business you're involved in. Make sure you ping Karen Cleary at kcleary@talknorth.com. That's her email. We just locked up our first sponsor. We'll get to that a little later here in April. Really excited about that endeavor, but we want to pump it up for you as well. So give Karen Cleary a quick message. Let's get your name. Let's get your business here front and center on Wooden Sticks. And after this quick break, we get to chat with Danny Brooks. All right, we are back on Wooden Sticks. As I mentioned in our intro, really excited to have a good friend of mine on today. He is Danny Brooks, the son of the great legendary coach Herb Brooks. Danny, calling us in from California. I'd love to hear your travel schedule, because we have so many mutual friends, from Mark McAsee to Ryan Carter to Pat Fabian. And I know you kind of spend some time here and some time out in glitzy California. Where are you at right now?
Yeah, well, I'm in Beverly Hills. 68 degrees and sunny, not a cloud in the sky, no humidity, no wind, no bugs. I've got an office in Beverly Hills. I walk the streets of Beverly Hills and I'm like, my head's on a swivel and I'm like, I'm from the east side of St. Paul. Is this really happening? And I wonder what my dad would say if, you know, he was alive, you know.
I think he'd have something to say, knowing her.
Oh, he would definitely have something to say. And I've got a funny story about that, too, real quick. I remember the first house I bought, he was coaching the New Jersey Devils. And he was letting me do it on my own. And I was looking in, you know, St. Paul, kind of the Mac Groveland area, you know, an old, you know, the starter houses of those neighborhoods, what have you. And it was between that and, you know, maybe into, you know, Minneapolis. I didn't really tell him Minneapolis. I decided I was going to buy in Minneapolis. He's coaching New Jersey Devils. It was 1992. And I called and told him, I said, well, I found my house. He's thinking I was going to say St. Paul. I told him where it was. And I told him the address, 3933 Ewing. And he said, where's that? And I says, it's in Minneapolis, right on the border of Edina. And he like dropped the phone. I could just I could just see the smoke coming from his ear, out of his ears.
I can't even imagine.
Minneapolis and Edina. Like, oh my.
It's the wrong combination for Herb Brooks. I can promise you that.
Yeah.
Well, and my dad was an east side.
Louis Schaefer was my roommate.
No kidding. Yeah. One of my teammates from St. Thomas. My dad was an east side St. Paul guy. And through the years, your dad and my dad got connected when your dad would do the hockey school down in Faribault. My dad being the golf pro there, they worked out a deal where Herbie could bring the coaches out to golf when they were down there in the summer for the camp. And I was lucky enough to be able to go to the hockey school free of charge. So it was a nice little kind of combo platter there that I was able to connect with your dad at a young age. And I thought it was fitting to connect up with you this week, learning that you're going to be dropping the puck at the Frozen Four. It's the 50-year anniversary of the very first national championship for Minnesota. Your dad was the coach back in 74, and it's back in St. Paul. It's the Frozen Four. It's an unbelievable time. It would have been, I think, a perfect finish to the story if the Gophers had got there. They fell a game short. But for you, Danny, to be a part of this and to honor your dad dropping the puck 50 years later, that's got to be pretty special.
Yeah, it is. It is. It, you know, the Gophers did something for that team. It was the last game of the season against Michigan. They had obviously invited all the whole team. About three quarters of the players were there. Joey Micheletti was a freshman. Joey's a fellow broadcaster, like yourself, Gorgie. He flew in. Buzzy Schneider was a sophomore. They had a great, you know, ceremony in center ice and hard to believe 50 years ago. And, you know, that Gopher team had no business beating that Tech team that year, by the way. That Tech team was absolutely stacked. And I don't know if you read Ricey's column, but the the semifinal game against Boston U, Polich scored the game winner with a minute left. It was a shorthanded goal. So oh, wow. You want to talk drama. I mean, think about that. A shorthanded game-winning goal in the semifinals of the NCAA. Unfortunately, no one can get their hands on any of the footage of that tournament. I actually didn't make that trip. It was Boston Garden. They beat Tech. Tech by far was the better team. That was a major upset. I actually stayed with Strelos, Warren Strelos, Warren and Carly Strelos. I stayed at their house. I was 6 years old going on seven. And the subsequent national championships that they were in, I actually went to those tournaments. Following year was in St. Louis. The year after that was in Denver. And then the last year, 79, was in Detroit. An interesting thing about my dad and his national championship teams, I don't know if you know this, but his three national championships that he won in the 70s, none of those teams were WCHA champions.
I did not know that.
The only year they won so my dad coached 7 years, three NCAAs. He only won the WCHA championship, only finished first once, and that was in 75 when they lost in the Final Four to Michigan Tech.
And what that tells me, Danny, is that was the premier league in college hockey, right? I mean, that was the league.
Without a question.
And everybody tried to measure up to that WCHA. And I think, you know, you and I are still old enough to have lived through a couple different eras of, I would call, glory years for college hockey in the WCHA. And I think when I started broadcasting at then, it was Fox Sports North. Now it's Bally Sports. But we would do the WCHA Final Five in St. Paul at the X. And I'm telling you, it was the premier college tournament of the year with the best players from the best conference. And I get why Minnesota went to the Big Ten. I understand all of the logistics, the money, the coverage. I get it all. But the landscape of college hockey at that point took a pivot, and it'll never be the same.
No. I mean, just the nostalgia of those, you know, late 60s, 70s into the 80s. I mean, you think about, you know, the teams that would come. I mean, Williams Arena, Gophers against Wisconsin. I mean, come on. Nothing like it. Against North Dakota, unbelievable. UND. I guess that's progress in college sports. The Frozen Four this year, it's kind of old school. I mean, you look at that lineup and you could say, is this 1978?
I know.
Is this 1985?
You've got 28 national championships between these four teams. They're maybe arguably, along with Minnesota, four of the five greatest programs in college hockey history. And you've got your Denver Pioneers in the mix. Yeah. It's going to be awesome. I mean, I know it's not going to be great for the bars and restaurants in town, because if Minnesota or North Dakota or Wisconsin or all of them were in there, it would be a whole different dynamic. But as far as the quality of hockey, the history of the programs, I don't think you can beat these four.
No, I mean, the only other thing, I mean, I guess you could throw Minnesota, Wisconsin, North Dakota in there, you know, would be similar, but it's amazing how it kind of come. And I assume you watch some of these games, and the talent these teams
amazing.
Have. Oh, God. I see a lot of NHL superstars that, you know, are going to be playing this, you know, next weekend in that tournament.
Well, and you got the kid that's 17 years old, that's going to be the first kid picked in the draft next year for BU.
Yeah.
You're seeing generational talent, and he's just one of probably six or eight players that will stand out the weekend of the Frozen Four in St. Paul. And I got to take it back to where we start with this show, which is Wooden Sticks. And I grew up playing youth hockey in Burnsville. You grew up playing over in Moundsview. And even though we were a year apart, I was a year older, we would every other year end up matching up in some tournaments, the teams that you were on.
Yeah.
And I've always wondered this, Danny, did you have a leg up on the gear side of things, whether it was sticks, equipment, because of your dad coaching at the U of M and maybe the access he had to some of that gear?
I did. Well, actually, interesting thing about me, so you and I are actually the same age. So we were the same years in youth hockey so I should have been an 85 grad, but with all the traveling later when I was a teen, you know, we lived in Switzerland, New York. So there was a period I went to six different schools in 3 years. One of them was German speaking. So I went,
whoa,
I, my parents, when my dad was coaching the Rangers, I was a sophomore, your sophomore year at Burnsville. They sent me back and I joined the ninth grade class at St. Thomas Academy. As a matter of fact, Mark Magsey was one of the first guys I met. My first, it was Thanksgiving week of 1982. So I was a sophomore and then joined the ninth grade class. So when we were growing up, I think you and I actually may have played against each other in some tournaments when I was Mounzu. So when I was a second year Pee-wee, you were a second year Pee-wee, what have you.
I remember those. I do remember that.
A long-winded answer is to I would get a lot of great equipment, a lot of great gear. I got all the good stuff. You know, one of the first guys to have a pair of toques, you know, back in the day.
Yes. And yes.
Then the Perfecta. That was the alternative to toque. I don't know if you remember that brand. It was another called Perfecta. They kind of had like ridges on the blade.
Oh, they were high end. I do know that.
Yeah, that's what I got. And then I'd wear, you know, I'd get like old Gopher jerseys and gloves and whatnot. And yeah, so that was the one of the many perks of being my father's son.
Well, I'm gonna flip the coin though for you, because what I remember about youth hockey and into high school is my mom always thought I played a good game, and I was the goalie, and it was pretty obvious whether it was a good or bad game. But my dad was my harshest critic. Now, he was also my biggest supporter, but if I had a bad night, he would be the first one on the drive home to kind of point out the mistakes I made. I knew your dad, and we all have gotten to know your dad over the years with the historical references, specifically the movie Miracle. I have to imagine Herb as a hockey dad had good and bad to it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, first, to kind of tell a story about him being a hockey dad. So when I was, Squirts, Pee-wee's, Bantams, actually, I didn't play Bantams in Minnesota much because we were in New York and Switzerland. He wasn't around a lot. He was so busy with the Gophers. I mean, a tireless worker. You got to remember, people don't realize this, my dad didn't have any money in his budget to hire an assistant coach. So the first paid assistant he had was like his fourth year as the coach. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, Brad Butel, you know, it was the first paid assistant in like 77. So if you look at a lot of those coaches early on in his career, they were all volunteers. Mike Foley was one, a volunteer. So anyways, he was very, very busy because he did everything for that program. So he didn't really see me play a lot. And during those, you know, Squirt Pee-wee years, Rich Horvath was my coach, Mark and Ricky's dad. Okay.
Oh, wow.
Ricky was the opposing goalie when you won the state tournament.
Yes, he was.
In 85. So yeah, so Rich Horvath was like a second father to me. I saw Rich more than I saw my own father. So my dad wasn't really around a lot. I was, how shall I say this? I don't want to say this, sound like I'm bragging, but I was always like a bigger kid, more advanced.
And so I remember that. Yeah, you were a beast.
I was pretty much, you know, especially the second year of my Squirts and second year Pee-wees, I kind of, you know, dominated a little bit, I guess, you know. So there wasn't really, you know, at that level, you know, he wasn't really, yeah, he did see me play, went to games, but I don't really remember him, you know, spending much time. The only thing he wanted me to do, he wanted me to play defense. So he talked me into going to the coaches or trying out for D or whatever. So I went from a forward to defensive, because I remember what he said. He said, good forwards are a dime a dozen. He said, but it's very rare to find a good defenseman. So he really didn't see me play much. And then in high school, you know, I was playing for St. Thomas Academy. He was still in New York. So he kind of saw me towards the end, my senior year. And was involved there. There was a couple of times where he kind of got on me because I played lazy or kind of took corners or whatever during some recruiting opportunities. I remember Red Berenson came and watched us play one game against Hill Murray, and I just sucked. I was terrible. And so he kind of let me have it after that game. And then when I was in Denver, he was really, really involved. There was a couple of years, you know, coached the North Stars my freshman or sophomore year, and then he was quote unquote in between jobs. So he saw me play a lot my junior and senior year. You know, back glory days of the WCHA, you know, he would travel to, you know, he'd go to Wisconsin, he'd go to North Dakota, go to UMD, come out to Denver. And my roommate at the time, Jay Moore, you know, Jay, don't you?
I do.
Yeah. So Jack Moore, Jay's dad, you know, those two would travel to all the games, go to Northern and whatnot. And then he was more of a guiding voice because I was drafted by St. Louis and he thought I could, you know, have a career at the next level. And but early on, Gorgie didn't really know just because he wasn't around. He was doing everything for the U.
Well, I got to take you back to 1980. I've been to Lake Placid. I didn't get there, Danny, until, I don't know, a handful of years ago. I was out with some buddies at Saratoga Racetrack, and in between our days watching the ponies, we took the drive over to Lake Placid. That was such a big moment in my life as a kid. I've told the story hundreds of times. You know, it was my 13th birthday that week of the Miracle on Ice game. I had a bunch of kids coming over for a pizza party to watch the game. Yeah. Bottom line is, it's the greatest sporting event I've ever watched. And so you were there as a teenager. I can't believe how small that town is. Like, going Isn't back there, I don't know where they put everybody. Like, I don't get it.
Crazy. I'm glad you brought that up because that was the first thing that I was going to say. Because I've been back a couple of times, and it's like, you're trying to tell me this place hosted the Olympics. It's just crazy. It's like Bemidji.
It is,
you know,
I'm not kidding. It is just like a small town in northern Minnesota. Like you walk downtown, you look around, you're like, this was the center of the sporting world. Like how, so yeah. I got to ask you were a teenager. What was that experience like?
It was crazy. I mean, the stories, Gorgie, I've got plenty. You know, I got going into that, like everybody, no one expected them to do anything. Right.
Right.
I was just excited because I got to, you know, get 2 weeks off of school. So I'd never been in New York City. So we flew to New York City to see the game up against the Soviets prior to the Olympics. Obviously, you know, that is, you know, well,
big loss, right? 10-3, I think.
Big loss, 10-3, could have been worse. I think the Soviets kind of, you know, took their foot off the gas, you know, later in the game. So watch that in Madison Square Garden. I can picture it well. One interesting point, no one really talks about this. That game, it sold out Madison Square Garden. It was an incredibly hostile crowd. I mean, hostile. You know, New York fans, you know how crazy they are. But I mean, the taunting, the commie this, commie that, pinko. I mean, just they were brutally, brutally hard on that Soviet team. And another thing too, that Soviet team sensed it and they were pissed. The Soviet team actually in that game kind of played a little bit chippy. You could tell they were pissed and didn't want to be there and didn't like that environment. So anyways.
That makes sense. That makes total sense now that I think about it. Sure.
Yeah. And so then we took an Amtrak from New York to Lake Placid.
How fun.
And so I remember pulling in and, you know, you heard the stories, you know, the buses weren't working and everything was kind of a cluster. And I remember walking into the rink. The first time I walked in the rink, I remember I could smell the fresh paint, brand new, and they were still working on the arena. You could hear like nails being pounded and saws going, you know, so they weren't like totally ready. And so first game, you know, it was actually the morning before, the day before the opening ceremony. And that's when, you know, they beat the Swedes. There's probably like 900 people in the arena. It was like a 10 o'clock game. And I remember it was just dead. I remember sitting across the rink in the lower bowl. Actually, there was only a lower bowl. But sitting across the rink, I remember I could hear the Swedish players talking on the bench, kind of yelling down at the bench. I could hear him speaking Swedish. That's how dead it was. I could hear it across
the wow bench. That's and, crazy.
And then obviously the big tying goal, which, you know, Ruzioni had a big one, obviously McClanahan had a big one against the Finns, but if Billy Baker didn't score that one, I don't know if you and I'd be talking right now, right?
It really so, did set then, the tone for the run.
Then 2 days later, it just like it, I mean, the most amazing thing, how it went from so dead, no one caring, no interest whatsoever, how it absolutely exploded. And just the energy of Lake Placid, it was just, and you know, you gotta remember, if you look what Eric Heiden did during that Olympics, I mean, might be the greatest, you know, accomplishment in the history of the Olympics, what he did, 5 gold medals in those different, you know, events in speed skating. But the hockey thing just exploded and took the, obviously the whole town, and you could just feel the whole thing just, you know, just taken off.
So the game, yeah, against the Soviets.
Yep.
Your dad famously leaves the bench right away. Soon after that game do you, your sister, and your mom get to connect with your dad?
So we saw him the night before, saw him the night after, which was, because that was a Friday night. We actually went to dinner with him on Saturday night, which was the night between the Soviet game and the Finn game. And actually, if your readers or listeners, I'm sorry, go to my Twitter page, I've actually got a picture of he and I having dinner at this bistro downtown Lake Placid. So I think that was the first time I saw him. Was at dinner, because they were secluded. They were staying at the, you know, the Olympic Village, and we met him downtown Lake Placid, not much of a downtown, this bistro, and it was packed, and Main Street was wall to wall people, you know. And we had dinner, and he was he was not there mentally. I mean, he was like literally squiggling line combinations on a napkin as we're having dinner. So that's
what
I saw.
That does not surprise me.
Yeah. And he was just, and you could, if you look at that picture on my Twitter account, you could see the look in his face. And then the next morning they played the Finns. And then when he left, I don't know if I ever told you this, or I don't know if you knew this, when he left the bench after the Soviet game, the first thing he did was, they had a little bit of a teeny, teeny little office in the balls of that building, you know, kind of close to the locker room. He called Paul Giel, who was the athletic director. He called Paul Giel. Because remember, my dad was still an employee for the Gophers. This was just a one-year leave of absence. So he didn't leave the University of Minnesota until May of 1980. So he still was an employee. So he was on the phone with Paul, you know, basically that entire 2 weeks. Those two were extremely close. And that's the first person he talked to was Paul Giel, who was the athletic director of the U.
And another guy that's a connection to my dad, because they would run their fundraiser golf event every summer down at Faribault. And so it's amazing. Yeah. The connections. And I remember
there's a picture of my dad and Paul Giel back in the late 70s. And they got the total like 70s coaches shorts, you know, and the tube socks that go up to their knees playing in that tournament.
Unbelievable. So, it was a big deal to have your dad come down for that event. And I just think of the influence your dad had and has, you know, again, a lasting influence still on the game of hockey. I'm working a Wild game last night. I knew we were taping this today, and I'm looking at Joel Eriksson-Ek, and I'm looking at Jonas Brodin and Kirill Kaprizov, and how your dad was the first one that really understood if the National League was going to get where it needed to go, they had to bring those players in from Europe. There had to be more of an influence. Right. And back in the 80s, it was just a smattering, man. And it wasn't the right players. I mean, Perolov Brassar was a guy that played for the North Stars in the early 80s. He wasn't Kirill Kaprizov, but your dad had that vision. The way the game is played now, Danny, is exactly what your dad was trying to push into that Olympics and then beyond. It's got to make you feel pretty good. Like, it's just amazing that now, 21 years removed from his passing, I still see his influence on the game at the highest level.
Yeah. He was a smart guy. He saw a lot of, he was correct, and he was very visionary. He was very prophetic. He saw things and predicted things that, you know, have come true. And you're right. You know, late 70s hockey was an ugly game. Broad Street Bullies. I mean, that was kind of a, you know, fun to think about, you know, fun to reminisce. But, you know, in reality, it was not, it's kind of a little bit of a blemish on the game.
For sure. It was.
You know, and he wanted, you know, he was a, you know, he was a hard charging, you know, he didn't want his teams to shy away per se on the physical stuff, but, you know, he was enamored with that style of play. I mean, when I was a kid, you know, your dad being the golf pro on the golf side, you probably, you know, grew up hearing stories about, you know, Ben Hogan and whatnot. I grew up hearing stories not of Johnny Unitas or, you know, Babe Ruth. I grew up hearing stories about these Russian hockey players that no one knew of. I mean, literally. Yes. I mean, my dad would tell stories about, you know, Alexei Yakushev, you know, and, you know, my buddies
were hearing trade stories. Chance.
Exactly. My buddies were, you know, hearing stories about, you know, Willie Mays, you know, so he was obsessed with that style of play. You know, he played, you know, he got his butt kicked as an American playing against the Soviets back in the, you know, back in the 60s and late 60s and even into the early 70s, because he played up until 71. And then, you know, all his international play against, you know, the Swedes and the Finns. So, yeah, he brought that style in. And another thing, people don't realize when he, his first year in New York, you know, the NHL, you know, it's still kind of a Canadian, you know, run league. It was way, way more so back in the early 80s. And it was hardcore old school Canadians. There was a lot of people in professional hockey. And I shouldn't, I don't mean to, you know, say bad things about the great country of Canada. My best friends are Canadians. I actually work for a Canadian company, but there's a lot of people, you know, across the border that were running the league and kind of the old guard that did not want him to succeed in New York. So that was really hard, really hard. And the Canadians, you know, they had their Summit Series of 72, right? So yep. I think a lot of the old school, you know, the Miracle on Ice, you know, there's an element that, you know, the Canadians kind of want to protect, you know. And again, the best man at my wedding was Canadian. So it's the one of the greatest countries in the world. But back then, you know, he had some challenges. Different. And yeah. And yep. So what he did, he and Craig Patrick, I mean, they called that New York Ranger team, they called them the Smurfs. I don't know if you remember that. That was their nickname. So they'd go to Philly, and this was the tail end of the Broad Street Bullies. You know, Bobby Clark was still playing. Bill Barber was still playing. Bob Hound Dog Kelly was still playing, kind of the tail end of the careers. They'd go and beat Philly, and literally the fans at the Spectrum, they had these little plastic Smurf dolls, and they just throw them out on the rink. Because they had, you know, Pavlich, Reho Ruotsalainen, Mike Rogers, you know, all these
tiny players. Yes.
Tiny players and totally different game. And they owned Philly, by the way.
Philly couldn't skate with them.
They
right.
owned Philly, yeah. So anyway, see, a lot. He would look at Kirill, and he would absolutely love Kirill, and he would love Eck. He would love Eck because, again, you know, my dad liked the, you know, he called the front of the net. You probably heard this. He called it Bloody Nose Alley, and I mean, Eck personifies, you know, owning Bloody Nose Alley, right?
Best I've ever seen, honestly. Oh, as far as pro players go, he takes a beating every single night and never changes. It doesn't matter when you're playing, early in the season, playoffs, mid-season, he always finds his way and he drives the opposition bananas. I mean, your dad would have loved that.
He would have loved it.
So the first time you see the movie Miracle, and again, I've seen, I'm a movie buff. I've seen every sports movie known to mankind. I got to tell you, as just an outsider and a fan of that being such an important sporting event in my childhood, I loved it. It's got to be a whole different perspective when you're Danny Brooks and you're going to the movie theater to see that movie and your family's portrayed. And a lot of this is about the relationship, you know, that your mom and dad had and your dad and his obsession with this job of beating the Russians. So you walk out of the theater, what was your very first impression of that movie?
So great, great question. A little bit of insight. So I saw the movie when it was about 85% done. I was fortunate enough to come out to the what they call the press junket. Do you know what one of those are?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I came out to the press junket. Disney, you know, was kind enough to fly me out, and so the press junket, they had a hotel in Century City, and you know, they're all, you know, all the actors and producer, director, what have you, in their rooms, and then the members of the press come and you interview all these players, all the actors and whatnot. And then we saw the movie at a screening at I don't know where it was in LA, but at just like a theater. It was about 85% done. And, you know, other movies were going on at the time. And, you know, Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn were there at the theater, like 7 o'clock on a Friday night. Right.
No kidding.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it was about 85% done. They had to touch up a couple of things, the music and a couple of things. But my first response when I saw it, I'm going to back up. The writer and the producer were the same two that did the movie The Rookie with Dennis Quaid.
Which
did,
I love.
You ever seen that movie? Yeah, absolutely. Which I love too. Phenomenal. So it was about Jimmy Morris who came back. So
yes.
The producer of the movie was a baseball player, was his minor league teammate, Jimmy Morris. And so that's how he got the idea to, like, you know, do this movie. So if you remember that movie, a Disney movie, it was a very happy-go-lucky, you know, movie, you know, kind of happy music and kind of, you know, cheery, happy. And then, you know, Mighty Ducks before that, you know, very happy-go-lucky, cheery. So I kind of thought it was going to be like that. So the first response that I had when I ever seen the movie Miracle, I'm like, oh my God, I was very surprised how heavy it was and yes. how serious it was. Again, I thought it was going to be like the Mighty Ducks, you know, and or the, you know, the Rookie. Yeah, you know, I guess the Rookie was somewhat serious, but it was, you know, it didn't have that heavy tone. And so that surprised me. I was surprised because the movie is mostly, you know, so much about my dad and Kurt Russell. So that surprised me. I thought it was going to be like, you know, Mark Johnson, you know, the star player, Jim Craig, the star player. I thought it was going to be like that. I didn't know it was going to be so much about my dad. And just the heaviness of it, again, surprised me. And the director, you know, I got to know him, talked to him at length. He was saying, you know, how they shot the movie. So next time you watch it, they wanted to shoot the movie like movies were produced in the late 70s. So a lot of close-ups, close-ups. So if you go watch, like, you know, like the Omen, you know, those 70s movies, how they kind of had that.
Oh.
So he wanted to kind of catch that or create, capture that vibe. So I love the movie. Again, it was surprised how serious it was. I haven't seen it a ton. I mean, I'll be honest with you, there's some emotional scenes in there for me. I've only
for sure.
seen it probably 4 or 5 times, and that's obviously a lot to see a movie, but compared to so many people out there who've seen it,
well, I've seen it 50 times. I mean, yeah, I've seen it at least 50 times, and I love how they tied the music into it. The music's a big part of that movie for me. And I go back to the start of the movie, Danny, for all of us that grew up in that era where the country was at, I thought they,
speech?
Yeah, they caught it like that right away. You're like, okay, I get this now. I think a big part of what you explained earlier, being in Lake Placid and how that thing just took off and had a life of its own, it manifested this entire country. And really, it, for a sporting event, it became the Super Bowl for like 2 weeks straight. Honestly, I mean, but that was a big part of it. Where we were as a country, we were kind of lost at that time, and we were downtrodden, and this group of college kids kind of changed everything.
Without a question. I always tell people, look, this was not a sporting event. It was more than a sporting event. This was a piece of major American history.
For sure.
Beyond any sporting event. And the beauty of that movie, I thought that captured it so well. I told the writer this, how there's the scene where Carter is giving his, you know, this is a crisis of confidence speech. And then they're showing the 80 team. They're out there playing football in the snow. So here you got the country that's just absolutely in the tank. And then boom, here's 20 college kids that are going to like pull us out, you know.
They have no idea what they're doing. Like, they're out there just being kids, right?
They have no idea. They're just out there, they're playing. So yeah, I thought it was, I thought the movie was phenomenal. Another thing about the movie that that was a little bit, I talked to Russell about this at, you know, that weekend when I saw the movie for the first time. He portrayed my dad. He acted like my dad did when my dad was older. Not because my dad was 42 years old in 1980. That's crazy to think how young he was. So that Kurt Russell character, I thought, was more like my dad when my dad was in his 50s and 60s. Kind of a slower talker, a more deliberate talker. You know, had the bifocals. Where my dad back then was a little bit more animated, a little bit more Bobby Knight-ish, you know?
Yes.
But he did portray my dad to a T like my dad when he was older. That would be the only thing that was a bit, I guess I would use the word off.
And I think that makes sense because your dad was a part of this. And I think Kurt Russell had a chance to visit with your dad, but he's seen your dad, you know, 20 years later. He just doesn't know 42-year-old Herb Brooks. Correct. So that does make sense to me.
Yeah, he didn't want to, and he said it would be physically, he goes, you know, I could have tried to look like a 42-year-old, you know, would have lost some weight. And he said, you know, then my face would have been like saggy or whatever. So he actually elected to kind of portray an older Herb Brooks, which is fine. I think it's one of Kurt Russell's greatest acting jobs, quite frankly.
Yeah, I agree. Totally agree. And he was better than Carl Malden. Remember Carl Malden? Oh. I mean, one of that whole thing. They got this one right. So I want to get back to you as a player before we run out of time. And I was talking to our mutual friend, Mark McAsee, about the mid-80s when Team Minnesota and Team Massachusetts would get together. Oh, for me, I remember, I never played in it, but I had a lot of buddies that did. And I think you had a chance to participate in that event in 1986. Were you guys hosting or did you travel?
We traveled. So my dad was the coach. This was one of the years he was quote unquote in between jobs. So it was right after he was let go in New York after, you know, 5 years in New York, and right before he took the North Star job. So he coached us. So it was basically an all-star team my senior year, the entire spring. As soon as the season ended for us in 86, we played with this group of guys. Bloomer was on that team, your teammate. Steve
George Palawa,
Joe. Yeah, well, this, when you talk about that, the sad thing is the two stars of the team sadly died in car accidents. So my dad and George Palawa. Steve Rolick was on that team, who now coaches, you know, Ohio State. Our four main defensemen. It was me and Lance Pitlick were partners, and then Randy Scarta and Dennis Vasky were partners. So we played the Vulcans a lot. We played the Rochester Mustangs.
USHL.
One of their defensemen was a young man by the name of Mike Hastings.
So head coach at Wisconsin right now.
He's coaching Wisconsin. And then the final formal tournament was actually in Boston. Well into May, and Brian Leach, you know, we play against Brian Leach, play against Greg Brown, who's coaching this BC team that's coming into town.
Yes.
So we won. Robbie Stauber was our goalie. We won it in overtime. Todd Harchie scored in overtime to win the whole thing. Remember Todd Harchie?
And I think for our listeners, this was the very best players at the, you know, you take the state of Minnesota, the best seniors, going against the best of the best from Massachusetts. And there was always that argument, you know, Minnesota had that big state tournament. We still have it. Massachusetts always thought they had more players, more talent. And it was great hockey. The very best that each state had to offer. That had to be a remarkable event to be a participant in.
It was phenomenal. Those guys, we all have the special bond, you know, Bloomer and, you know, Tom Quinlan was on that team. Remember Quinny?
Oh God, was he a good hockey player? Holy smokes! Bill Murray, man, he was so good.
Did you play? Well, you know Rob, didn't you? Rob played baseball as well.
I knew all the. I you know Tommy. I played against him in '85. Craig Quinlan and I played college hockey together. He was a defenseman that was younger.
That's right.
But I think Damian Rose was on your team as well, right?
Damian was not. So surprisingly, he was not. So our goalie, Robbie Stauber, was our goalie, and then Steve Nelson from Grand Rapids. Wow. And then you know who else kind of helped out and played? Ricky Horvath from Hill, and Bob Peters' son from Bemidji.
Well, he was a great goalie out of Bemidji, sure.
Really good goalie. But Robbie was kind of our, you know, went on to, obviously went to Hobie. I mean, he was kind of our main guy. Bloomer, Tommy Sagasaur, Brad Stepan. Pitlick and I played, quite a bit together. You think of Stepan, this is how old we are. So Stepan, not only did he my teammate back then. So he had a son that not only played in the NHL, he's retired now. That's how old we are. His son is now like,
he works for the Wild. He's one of our scouts. Yeah. So, I mean, he's retired.
For Wild, so yeah,
we both played in the 85 state tournament. So now, I do. I every time I see him, I'm like, oh my God, I played against your dad and now you're retired. This is depressing.
Unbelievable.
You end up at Denver. I have to imagine you had choices. How did you become a Denver Pioneer?
So John Harrington's the assistant coach. I was a big, the glory days of WCHA. I loved Colorado College. I spent a lot of time in Colorado Springs. You know, that's where the 80 Olympic team was actually picked, was at the Broadmoor World Arena. First time they got together after the 79 Sports Festival was in the bowels of the building of the Broadmoor World Arena. I spent a lot of time in Colorado Springs. I wanted to go to CC. Minnesota was in the mix. Wisconsin a little bit came late, but it's kind of between Denver and CC. And 86, I don't know if you remember this, Denver were WCHA champs, was WCHA champs 86. They swept Minnesota early at Williams Arena in the fall of 85. And I'm like, oh my God, these guys are unbelievable. Then they swept Minnesota in Denver again later in the year. And so,
which never happened. The Gophers never got swept twice.
No, 85, 86. And they, both those teams, by the way, went to the Frozen Four that year. So, went to Denver and I just loved the whole vibe. And, you know, Ralph Backstrom, you know, won 6 Stanley Cups, NHL Rookie of the Year, 1958 was my coach. John Harrington was my assistant. So I was only one of only a couple Americans on that, on those Denver teams from 86 to 90. All my teammates were pretty much all Western Canadian kids. I had a ball, great school, living in Colorado, playing in that league, during those years. You know, the sun shines in Denver more often than Southern California. So great experience. Loved it. Had some epic battles against the Gophers in North Dakota and, UMD. And phenomenal experience.
Now, you had a chance to – you were drafted by the Blues, I believe, and your dad knew it. I think you knew it as well. Pro hockey might be something you could end up doing. Now, you've – again, we're going back in the time machine, and we know now how successful you've become in the financial world. How long did you pursue professional hockey, and when did you realize you want to do what you're doing now?
Yeah, I was a little bit burnt out. I just, it was time to move on. I worked hard in school and wanted to pursue something, different. And, I had a lot of older friends that were playing in, the International League, and I'm like, I don't want to play them. Peoria, Illinois for 17 grand a year and bus to Fort Wayne. And I'm just like, it's time for me to move on. So,
it's worked out. Okay.
Back then, not as many college kids were going, to the bigs back then, way more so than the 70s. But today, obviously these college kids are becoming NHL superstars. It kind of reminds me of my dad was a top of, think about this. My dad, when he played in the late 60s, he was the top, 10, 15 American hockey player in the country. So there's no way in hell he would have had a chance to play in the NHL. Now, think about this. If you're the 10th best American-born hockey player, you're an NHL superstar.
You're a first-round draft pick. It's a different world.
Totally. So
it's a completely different world now.
So I had, playing the WCHA 4 years for University of Denver. I mean, I wouldn't trade it for anything.
All right, Danny, we're to the final leg of the journey. It's the hat trick hot seat. I'm going to ask you 3 questions. There's no wrong answer. And you've already ruined it because I can't ask you the best sporting event you've ever attended. We know that already. You were there in Lake Placid in 1980, so I've got to shuffle the deck a little bit. I'll start with this one on the hot seat. We all kind of went back to watching TV series during the pandemic, and maybe you go back even further like I do to Seinfeld, which is my answer, but your all-time favorite television series to watch?
Oof. This is kind of a guilty pleasure. Might be a little embarrassing. I kind of like, and again, you and I are the same age. I think you're probably 2 months older than me. I got to tell you, rare, and you don't see it too often, but when Gilligan's Island's on.
Yes, I knew you were going there. Yeah.
To watch Gilligan, I mean, it's like, you got to be kidding me. This was actually a show, and it's, I love those reruns, those after school in the 70s, you come home, watch Gilligan's Island. Oh my God, it's the best.
I never missed it, but I have to, again, there's a follow-up question now, Ginger or Marianne, man?
Yeah, I was a Ginger all the way.
Okay.
Tina Louise is the only remaining castaway alive.
The bombshell. Of course she is. Again, of course she is. All right. Next question. You're going to play golf, probably out at a really nice golf course in California later this weekend, and you can pick any three former professional athletes on planet Earth to join you to be a part of this foursome. Who plays with Danny Brooks this weekend?
It doesn't matter the sport. They obviously have to be alive. Is that right?
They got to be on the earth. They got to be a former professional athlete. I'm sure you've met many, but yep. You only can pick three.
Only pick three former athletes. I would say Wayne Gretzky.
Yes.
That's an easy one. I would say Gary Player, which wow. That's a little bit out of left field. And I would say Barry Sanders.
Oh, what a great pick. What a great pick. Because Gary Player is the outgoing one. You got Barry Sanders, the shy one, maybe the greatest running back in the history of football.
I absolutely loved him.
But being the hockey guy, you had to have the great one in the group. That's an excellent foursome. Great answer. And we're going to close with this one. I'm guessing it's going to be very similar to my first concert, but the first concert you ever attended, where was it? What year was it? And who did you see?
Easy one. 1981, St. Paul Civic Center, Ted Nugent. It was the Wango Tango Tour. entered the stage. He swung on a rope wearing a loincloth and a big Indian headdress.
I love it. I just love it.
Ted Nugent, 1981, Wango Tango Tour.
So you had, yeah, you probably had to get dropped off at the concert and picked up, I would imagine, by mom, I'm assuming.
I did. Yeah, I did. I was a big Kiss fan. My parents never let me go see Kiss just because.
I had to hide those albums. No, I'm with you. You know, I grew up a strict Catholic, and I had to hide my Kiss albums for years and play them when my folks couldn't hear. No, honestly, that was a legitimate thing. My first concert wasn't until 83. It was at the Met Center, and Bryan Adams was the warm-up act, if you can believe that.
Journey. I remember that was a big, they're like three shows, right? Bryan Adams and Journey, right?
Yeah. It was amazing. I mean, and Journey to this day is still my very favorite band. And I between the Met Center and the Civic Center, I saw Prince later in the era of Purple Rain on Christmas Eve day.
Over Christmas. Yeah.
I got in big trouble for that.
I was at that same show.
Oh, we were so lucky. Like, Minnesota's always been able to get some of the greatest acts in music. And because we have so many great musicians that grew up in this era and in this area, just phenomenal. So yeah, fun to circle back.
One last point before we go about parents and music. I remember growing up back in the day, like in the late 70s, like the Rolling Stones. I mean, when rumor had it, like the Stones were coming in town, like they're going to play the Civic Center. Our parents were like, oh my God, the Stones are coming to town. Like, lock up your daughters. I mean, literally, that's what it was like.
It was 100%. And our parents probably, because of when we grew up, 70s and 80s, you heard all the, I'm sure they heard all the horror stories of the women. But again, they're not running through the neighborhood. These women are showing up at the concert. They're showing up at the hotel. But yet, you know, I had two sisters and it was the same thing in my house. Like, you're not going near that show. It was a big deal. Okay.
Well, I know we're out of time, but one last story about my dad and music. So long story short, so he's taken me and Ricky Strallo and Warren Strallo. He'd go, a lot of the high school games were played at the St. Paul Auditorium. Okay, now the Roy Wilkins, right yep. next to the Civic Center. So I remember one time there was a concert at the Civic Center, and we're like, you know, my dad's pushing through all these like long hairs, everyone's smoking dope. He's like, look at all these hippies. Look at all this. It was Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Yes.
Played at the Civic Center, and there's a high school game next door, and my dad's taking us through the crowd of the Skynyrd concert before the plane crash, by the way.
Can you imagine? So it was the original.
The
original band like members.
1976. He's taking us to a high school game at the auditorium, and Skynyrd was playing at the Civic Center.
I vividly remember going to some Mariner Dolphin games in that same time of our hockey. You know, back in the day, old school high school hockey. Mariner Dolphins no longer around.
They had the regions were played there.
It was a great place to watch hockey.
Oh, phenomenal. Oh. Yeah.
Unless Lynyrd Skynyrd was there and your dad was freaking out, that's a whole different problem to have. But, oh, great, Danny, great memories. Really can't thank you enough for this walk down memory lane. We'll have to have you on again. Just there isn't enough time to cover the ground I wanted to get to. I've got like 15 other things in my notebook that I didn't get to. But just hearing these stories and, you know, having the chance to kind of go back with you to such a special time. I know for your family, but for all of us that love the game and in 1980, for most of us of a certain age, the greatest sporting event that we'll ever live through. So I can't tell you how much fun I had today.
If you want to get to those other questions, I'm game. I had a blast. Thanks for having me.
Thanks again. We'll be right back. Quick break here. You're listening to Wooden Sticks on the Talk North Podcast Network. Back on Wooden Sticks, and you probably sensed it throughout the conversation that we probably had more ground to cover. We absolutely need to have Danny back on the show. Love the way he can really tell stories, and I can sense just the love and passion in his stories about the game of hockey, but more importantly about his dad, and you know, rightfully so, right? When your dad is Herb Brooks, I just can't imagine. Just how much, you know, you miss that. You miss the conversations and, you know, reliving some of those great moments. We lost Herb way too young at 66 back in 2003. And as I mentioned, you could sense it too, listening to our conversation here. They don't come any better than Danny Brooks. Just a wonderful guy, a tremendously successful person. He's always been that guy, but you'd never know it seeing him. He's always carried himself, just with so much composure and just such a humble human being, and just really thoroughly enjoyed tapping into some of those great hockey stories that he had today. And, you know, going back in time and being basically transported back to Lake Placid in 1980. And I think the wonder of it all when it comes to great moments in sports is even if you weren't alive, like Danny and I were and teenagers at that time, because of the movie Miracle, because of the internet and going to places like YouTube where you can actually watch some of those broadcasts back, the documentaries that have been out there on ESPN and other networks, he can put you in a place that you can relate to because you've seen enough of the other coverage to kind of understand what a big deal it was. And he's the son of that coach that pulled off that unbelievable upset and then validated that a couple days later to get that gold medal. It's certainly something that will always be special if you were able to live through that time in our country, and it's specifically in the game of hockey. It stands out as just one of the most remarkable sporting events of all time. And so to have that firsthand knowledge from somebody that lived through it in the family with the head coach, remarkable stories today from Danny Brooks. We're looking forward to some great episodes here now as We get into the heart and soul of college hockey coming to a climax. We touched on that with the 50-year anniversary at the Frozen Four. If you're able to get down there and see Danny and drop that puck, I think that'd be a really important thing to do. It's going to be an awesome weekend. And even though we didn't get any Minnesota connections or North Dakota or Wisconsin fans to the metro area with those four programs, it's going to be a tremendous weekend of hockey. And Dan Brooks will be dropping the puck for the 50-year anniversary of the 1974 National Championship. And we'll look forward to some more great guests here throughout the month. We're going to have some Stanley Cup playoffs starting soon. It likely will not include our favorite team, the Minnesota Wild, but we might have some special guests on that have been a part of some great playoff hockey here in this market and places beyond. I'm talking Matt Cullen comes to mind as a guy we want to talk to, Mark Parrish, Josh Harding. These are players that I've connected with here in the last couple of weeks, and we've got some wonderful shows coming up. Don't forget, you can be a part of the show too. Karen Cleary is the hook. We'll get you on our show. You'll be one of the sponsors here that we can pump up week in and week out on Wooden Sticks. It's K Cleary, C-L-E-A-R-Y, at talknorth.com. It's Wooden Sticks. I'm Kevin Gorg. We thank you for listening and look forward to our next show coming out next week.